Élections générales au Québec. Pour savoir où voter et pour connaître la liste des candidats qui se présentent dans votre circonscription, consultez la carte de rappel jaune que vous avez reçue par la poste ou visitez notre site Web. Pour voter, vous devrez présenter une pièce d'identité. Les bureaux de vote seront ouverts de 9h30 à 20h. Pour plus d'informations, consultez le www.élections.québec ou communiquez avec nous au 1-888-ÉLECTIONS. Le 3 octobre, on inverse la tendance. Tout le monde vote. Un message d'Élections Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We are a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world. Fighting for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli regime jails has never been so hard. Indeed, one of the organizations fighting for that freedom is Al-Damir, the Palestinian Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association. This NGO was one of the six leading human rights and civil society groups that was criminalized by the Israeli regime last year. They work in the service of over 4,650 Palestinian political prisoners, among them 180 children, who are being unjustly held and by international law standards illegally in Israeli jails. Now, in the last few months alone, we've seen some of these cases hit headline news, including the case of Ahmed Manasra, who was arrested as a 13-year-old child and has spent the last 7 years of his imprisonment in and out of solitary confinement. An international campaign calling for his release because of his worsening mental health situation was ignored by the Israeli regime prison authorities. We also saw the case of Khalil Awade, who went on hunger strike for 172 days in protest of his administrative detention. More on that practice a bit later in the episode. So joining us to discuss what it means to fight for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners at a time like this is Milena, the International Advocacy Coordinator for Al-Damir. Milena is also a lawyer registered in the Palestinian Bar Association. Her work focuses on submitting appeals, complaints, and reports on behalf of the Palestinian prisoners to the United Nations and relevant actors, while also building international solidarity campaigns. Milena, thank you so much for joining me on Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Can you tell us about what your work has looked like since the Israeli regime criminalized Adlamir? What has it meant for you and those that you work with on a day-to-day basis?
So first, to begin with, it will be almost a year since the designation and the outlawing next month. So we have been living under this axe that is above our heads for almost a year now. And I can clearly say that it has some physical implications, negative implications. And as well, of course, we can't deny or ignore the psychological or the mental aspect of it. Following the designation in October, late October, and the outlawing by an Israeli military order beginning of November, our first concern was the people that we serve. And because Adlamir provides free legal services to Palestinian political prisoners, we provide consultation as well to their families, and we do workshops and trainings for our community under workshops called Know Your Rights. So we basically were worried first thing at the people we serve. So the Israeli occupation wouldn't retaliate against us as organizations through the people we serve and the detainees and prisoners. So on that note, our legal services did halt for a while, where our lawyers have become private lawyers, not part of Adlamir, or they don't have direct connection or relations with Adlamir. And so this was difficult to work around, because we also document the systematic violations of Palestinian prisoners and detainees' rights in order to advocate on their behalf on an international level as well. And so it was a bit difficult to follow up on the reportings and testimonies and legal procedures, because there was some kind of a disconnect between the legal unit and the lawyers and the work that we do. Mainly, we stopped getting any families or prisoners to the offices, because we know that will directly put them under the attack of the Israeli occupation. On an international level, regarding our advocacy work, we have proudly continued the work, and if I might add, even strongly, because of course the designation had very much negative impact on the work that we do, shifting our work from defending the prisoners and the detainees to trying to defend our legitimate work that we do under international law. But for the designation, it also provided us a wider platform. We saw many organizations and people who weren't usually supporting us understand what's going on and see it in the headlines, in the news. So it did provide us some kind of a bigger platform to use our voices to advocate on behalf of prisoners and detainees. And that was the case. We tried as much as possible to shift the attention from the six organizations to the people we actually serve. So the designation targeted organizations that work with women, that work with prisoners, children, farmers and peasants in Area C, researchers, and like Al-Haq, an organization that focuses on the systematic violations of human rights on different levels, like businesses or whatnot. So we tried as much as possible to focus the platform that was given to us by, sadly, the designation to highlight the work that we do. But of course, many times organizations or the international community wanted to know more about how we are being affected and what's going on. So these are the restrictions. We try to change the nature of the work that we do in order to bear in mind that we are not putting any of the people who take services from us at risk. We continued prison visits, of course. We are continuing with international advocacy, but the workshops that we do under Know Your Rights with students either in universities or schools or Palestinian culture centers, we have halted, to be honest, because according to the Israeli counterterrorism law of 2016 that we are designated by, any person who takes services from us or provides us with services could be held criminally liable. And we already know student groups and universities are already targeted by the Israeli occupation. So we did not want to add more to that. But basically, all the information we provide, the workshops are online on our website. So they're still available, but there's no direct communication. Maybe that's a bit more on the people that we serve level. But on the employees level and staff, like the daily life of staff, I would maybe focus more on the psychological aspect. Usually in Palestine, we don't really talk about mental health or the psychological stability of a person. But as you can imagine, we are all still working. Like, none of the employees of the six organizations, any of them left their job or retired or wanted to quit, because this designation aims to silence Palestinian voices, and we didn't want to give the Israeli occupation what they needed, basically. And it only made us stronger to know that the work that we do is actually making a difference on an international level. So we need to continue stronger, but we can't ignore the personal risk we are putting ourselves under to continue the work that we do in our offices and using our names to speak up and report on the systematic violations. Of course, there's also the financial aspect of it. Because the designation does target our assets or financial accounts, they could be seized at any moment. But thankfully, most donors and sponsors have continued their support. But that doesn't mean that banks won't seize our assets or stop our accounts. Because as you know, banks care more about money and businesses than human rights. So the moment they will feel a threat from the Israeli occupation that you have bank accounts for these organizations, they will target them and hold them accountable. And we do fear that our assets could be seized at any moment. As I mentioned, employees work at their own personal threat. You can't help but wonder if I will ever be arrested when crossing checkpoints, when speaking into webinars or panels. Will there be arrest happening? Will there not be? And of course, this is not Palestinian paranoia. I hope we do focus on that. The Israeli occupation has the policy of arresting students, civil society actors, either based on a list of charges or they don't even provide charges and they arrest them under administrative detention. The director of the Health Work Committee, which was also outlawed by the Israeli military orders, was arrested and served nearly a year in harsh conditions in Israeli prisons. And she is the director of the Health Work Committee, a 60-year-old civil society actor, Ms. Shada Oudeh. So we do fear the retaliation on a personal level, but we prioritize the work that we do and how much we serve the people in Palestine. And it's important for us to always keep a voice for Palestinians on an international level, especially for prisoners, because they tend to be a bit isolated away from any contact with the outside world.
It is impressive how Damir and other organizations have managed to continue their work and adapt their work in this incredibly repressive atmosphere. And thank you for being so candid and talking about the strain on mental health of Palestinians who work in these organizations and other civil society spaces, because I think that's something that's sometimes overlooked by even by international allies and partners. But I wanted to ask you, why would the Israeli regime do this? As you mentioned, you know, the Israeli regime doesn't need an excuse to arrest people, to raid NGO offices. So why this designation? To what end?
So the designation, to be honest, wasn't a complete surprise to Palestinian civil society. Maybe the only shock factor that was there during the designation is that they designated six prominent, and I'm humbly saying this, prominent and leading civil society organizations in Palestine. So the brutality and the evilness of this designation comes that they target six different organizations that work in different fields and different aspects in the Palestinian life. But why I say we weren't very much surprised, because for the past years, and even more, if I could say that, the Israeli occupation has enforced a campaign, a wide-scale campaign that's still ongoing, targeting Palestinian civil society and human rights defenders. So this campaign includes like arbitrary arrests, raids on offices, travel bans on employees, Pegasus spyware on phones of employees and staff as well, and different retaliation methods or harassment methods. Like, for example, a lot of NGOs that are affiliated with the Israeli occupation, I do want to name one of them, NGO Monitor, has systematically discredited our reporting and our attendance to the Human Rights Council in the United Nations. Every time we would submit a report or even submit oral interventions to the Human Rights Council, they would prepare a counter report that targets the employees of the organization. They would go through the social media accounts of the employees and say, look, these are the employees of the organization, so you can only discredit the reporting that you do. So for a long while, Al-Damir has faced a lot of these. We were raided in 2012 and 2019. In 2019, we were literally documenting the systematic use of torture and ill treatment in El Maskoubiya Interrogation Center. And when they raided our offices, 3 laptops were taken, also computers, hard disks and memory cards, and legal files as well. So these legal files held inside of them testimonies of Palestinian prisoners and detainees stating that this is what they were subjected to and the different torture methods. And we never got these files back, or we never heard about anything regarding the raid. So we've been through this, sadly. So this campaign mainly aims for, if I note them down, they will be more than 3 points, but mainly 3 main points. The goal is for the Israeli occupation to silence any Palestinian organization that exposes their war crimes and crimes against humanity on ground. It also aims to isolate Palestinian civil society, because sadly, whenever Israel uses the word terrorism, the international community somehow closes their eyes and turns their face on the other side. And they don't challenge the Israeli narrative of what terrorism is. They don't challenge these designations because I don't know why, but we can only imagine political pressure and political powers play a huge favor. So it's isolating and silencing Palestinian civil society. And also we would note the second aim is to evade accountability. Most of the 6 organizations constantly report on the systematic violations, as I mentioned, DCIP, Defense for Children International in Palestine, Al-Haq and Al-Damir are 3 organizations that closely work with the International Criminal Court, where we file reports to the Office of the Prosecutor asking for genuine justice and accountability for the Palestinian people against what the Israeli occupation applies in Palestine, all across Palestine. So our organizations are calling the Office of the Prosecutor to hold the Israeli Minister of Defense accountable for these violations and war crimes and crimes against humanity. And this same person, the Minister of Defense, is now calling us terrorist organizations for the work that we do. We definitely understand that every time Israel feels like the international community is somehow moving to hold them accountable, either with the ICC or different UN resolutions, and we see them fighting back with discrediting campaigns. It's really important to note that the 6 organizations play a really important part in changing the narrative or the power dynamics on an international level, where we use international law standards, international human rights law, humanitarian law, and legal analysis to provide all the proper reporting regarding why we say what's going on ground is an apartheid regime. Why we say it's a settler colonial and occupation regime that constantly violates basic rights for Palestinians. And going back to the 3 points, this campaign of targeting civil society also aims at defunding the organizations. Because as much as we can say that we are resilient, we will continue our work, if there's no financial support, there's no partners and organizations that also finance these projects that we do and the work that we do, I can honestly say this, I'm not sure we can continue our work, even with our resistance and resilience to continue. We've been doing a lot of diplomatic briefings, a lot of meetings with diplomats or parliamentarians. And we hear a lot that Israeli lobby is targeting the states that do donations or sponsors to these organizations. And they immediately ask them, why are you still financing these terrorist organizations? So we understand that the defunding aspect of this campaign is very important for Israel. And this is what they really focus on. Discrediting the organizations, portraying them as evil villains, up to military activities and whatnot, in order to scare the international community from continuing to support our organizations. The Israeli occupation, as you mentioned, doesn't really need proper evidence or proper procedures or due process rights. This designation itself is left at the discretion of the Israeli Minister of Defense, the person who we are calling a war criminal, and we want him to be held accountable for what this regime has been establishing for the past 70 plus years. And from this sense, we understand that this targeting comes to really try to affect the voices on the international community.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work.
Milena, perhaps if you could briefly tell us what the international response has been and what it should be, what is it lacking?
So in the beginning, before the raid, because the six organizations, in addition to one other organization, the Health Work Committee, were raided 3 weeks ago, where the Israeli occupation, during a dawn raid, so at 4 a.m. in the morning until 6 a.m., they entered Area C, which is under the Palestinian Authority and sovereignty, in a way, territorial jurisdiction. And they raided the offices. Some offices had their equipment completely taken and confiscated. We are not sure what they did in there, whether they left anything for us as spyware or whatnot. But other offices didn't have much files confiscated or material. But all the six organizations were sealed and closed forcibly by the Israeli occupation. So before this raid, the work of the international community was basically just statements of solidarity. Nights submitted a statement saying that the Israeli occupation hasn't yet provided us any substantial evidence regarding the designation or the outlawing, and hence we will not take this designation into accordance or into account. But then the statement from the nine EU member states in the second paragraph says, sadly, and it's very unfortunate that it continues like this, it says, should Israel provide us with additional information, we will act accordingly. And why I say it is unfortunate, it's because the continuation of this sentence entails that we are giving Israel the green light to provide whatever information they need or evidence. And why I say this is problematic, because Ad-Damir has been working in the Israeli judicial system for the past 30 years. We have seen students being prosecuted and arrested based on very bogus charges. And we have seen children being detained for years under secret files and the use of administrative detention. So we understand that when Israel talks about evidence, they even talk about arresting people and subjecting to torture and ill treatment during the interrogation to try to gain whatever testimonies or evidence they can. I comfortably say about evidence and mention it because we are almost positive that there are no evidence against the organizations. But how the international community keeps on tiptoeing and walking around eggshells around Israel not to try to piss it off or try to go against its laws, it's completely ridiculous and it could be taken as double standards. I don't believe anywhere in the world a government can designate six prominent civil society organizations as terrorist organizations without providing any justification at all. And the international community till now is allowing to hear some arguments from the Israeli occupation. Like recently we heard that an Israeli delegation is back again in the US to put pressure on the Biden administration to take action and to confirm this designation. Although the US has been saying there's no substantial evidence. So we've seen more solidarity and more words following the raid. And during our meetings with diplomats and whatnot, they kept asking us, were any of your staff arrested, or did any of the raids happen? And we would say, till now, no one was arrested from the employees. There wasn't any forcible closure of the organizations. And we felt like this fed into the argument that's in their own head, that the designation is just a minor threat. There wouldn't be following acts by the Israeli occupation, like arrests or closure. Although we made sure that they understand that the threat is real, the threat is imminent, and it could happen at any moment. So the raid from 3 weeks ago, I think definitely was a message to the diplomats, the international community, that a peaceful designation, or it's not a designation for the words only, but there will be action against the organizations followed. I believe most of the international community did not believe Israel would actually come to the Palestinian territories and forcibly close the organizations. So the raid was a message that this threat is real. Forcible closure could happen at any moment. Arrest of employees could happen. And so following the raid, we are seeing more maybe genuine support and solidarity from the international community. So far, there hasn't been any actual acts. It's still solidarity statements. But following the raid, 16 European countries with the Palestinian prime minister came to Al-Damir's offices to reopen the offices as a sign of defiance. And most of the 16 representatives were in the offices at that time, and the EU representative had a statement saying that we continue the support, we understand this is an arbitrary attack. But of course, still, that's not enough. As I mentioned, we're still seeing this narrative of waiting for the Israeli occupation to provide more evidence. And sadly, it's a disappointment to hear these things, because I feel like the international community sometimes neglects to remember that the Palestinian people are under an occupying regime, an occupation. Israel is the occupying power. We are the occupied people. So when something like this happens, power dynamics need to be taken into consideration. The right for the Palestinian people to resist this ongoing occupation with whatever means provided for them is always neglected in these scenarios. And we put the pressure and the work on the Palestinians to try to prove this baseless designation wrong. And this is the most nerve-wracking thing about the international community, that they don't immediately challenge Israel, that is the occupying power, but they challenge the Palestinians to try to prove that this is part of a harassment campaign and ongoing targeting for the Palestinian people. So if I have the ability to tell the international community what kind of actions need to be taken exactly, I would just sum them up with two main points. One is to immediately put pressure on the Israeli occupation to revoke the designation, because as I mentioned over and over again in this podcast, that as long as the designation is there, we are all at imminent risk of all the arbitrary procedures and measures that the Israeli occupation can and will hold against us. We will continue to live in this anxiety and state of instability and unknowing about what the future holds for us. It's not about, for example, the UK saying, this is Israel's designation, we won't follow. So what Israel does, we won't abide by it. It can't be like that. It needs a clear message that this designation needs to be revoked. And the other message is to always continue to support Palestinian civil society, and not by statements. And I also would like to say not by financial support, but by holding the Israeli occupation accountable. This nature of impunity that the international community keeps on granting Israel only provides Israel the green light to grow bigger and do more violations of human rights, because they know the international community won't say anything. In the past, they started with a few settlements, and everyone in the international community is saying settlements are illegal. But we are seeing the expansion of settlements day by day. And European countries answer this by saying, we will only identify the Israeli settlement products in our supermarkets, but we can't completely boycott Israeli settlements. So this is also part of the impunity that is granted by the international community to Israel. A prominent journalist like Shirin Abu Akleh was murdered by the Israeli occupation. And after months of them actually admitting that they are the ones who actually killed her, they still said, we won't hold anyone accountable. So this culture of impunity does need to end.
Milena, I want to turn our attention to the Palestinian prisoners and the situation inside Israeli regime prisons at the moment. Now, the Gilboa prison break happened over a year ago. What has happened inside of Israeli prisons since then?
So since the Gilboa escape in 2021, the Israeli prison services instituted a series of collective punishment measures against all Palestinian prisoners all across the different prisons. Most of the Islamic Jihad prisoners or affiliated with the Islamic Jihad were put in solitary isolation for weeks and even months. So there was a complete closure of all Israeli prisons where family visits or lawyer visits were halted. So soon after the Gilboa escape, a few of these measures were lifted, like the closure on prisons, but many other important retaliatory measures were kept. For example, a lot of the Islamic Jihad prisoners were kept in isolation. But the most important collective punishment method that the Israeli prison services did is that they started to initiate this procedure where the detainees and prisoners with long sentences will be transferred from their prison cells every 3 months and from their prison as a whole every 6 months. And of course, that's completely arbitrary against the Palestinian prisoners because it affects their social life inside prison. And also it subjects them to instability. So the prisoners' movement collectively announced a collective open hunger strike in the beginning of September, where their demands were very clear. We want the Israeli prison services to completely revoke their idea of transferring prisoners from outside of their cells or prisons, and to also free the Palestinian prisoners who were still in isolation. Of course, if you know anything about the history of prisons, we know that hunger strikes have historically been the only method where prisoners and detainees protest the harsh detention conditions and their administrative detention specifically. So before going through the hunger strike on the 1st of September, the Israeli prison services bowed down to the demands of the prisoners and they removed the policy of forcibly transferring prisoners every 3 months and 6 months. So the prisoners, since they got their first demand successfully, they did not initiate the open hunger strike. And we are seeing more of the Palestinian prisoners who were in isolation following the Gilboa escape and be released. So in a way, it was very successful for the collective Palestinian prisoners movement. But the restrictions on prisoners are still there regarding more head counting during the day. So if it was only during the morning and evening, now it's more regular regarding the count. But it was extremely difficult for the prisoners following the Gilboa escape, I might add. But we're slowly seeing them gaining some kind of rights back because they were threatening with this collective open hunger strike.
And Milena, can you tell us about the new administrative detainee hunger strike?
Before going into the new hunger strike for the administrative detainees, I do want to give some time to focus on administrative detention. And because with the advocacy work that I do, when there's a hunger striking detainee facing imminent threat to life, we get a lot of media interviews and a lot of coverage, and because this person is at imminent threat to life. But I think the international community or people around the world only begin to stand in solidarity with Palestinians when they are at imminent risk of death or deteriorating health conditions. And I do want to emphasize that our focus should be on the use of administrative detention as a policy and not how Palestinians choose to protest this administrative detention. Because for the past 2 years, the Israeli occupation has increased in a very unprecedented way the use of administrative detention, which is detention without trial, without charge, based on a secret evidence or secret file, and for an indefinite time. So there's no specific duration for this detention, and no charges are presented. When I first started with Ad-Damir, I was talking about 300 administrative detainees. And now I'm talking about 743 administrative detainees. This is the policy that needs to completely end. We need to tackle administrative detention as a widespread policy because recently, as I mentioned, the increased numbers of administrative detention is targeting former prisoners. And that is systematic harassment for former prisoners. It also targets the elderly Palestinian generation, where you have someone like Bashir Khairi, who's 90 years old, being held under administrative detention for more than a year without providing any evidence. And you have children who are also subjected to this same policy. And if I want to talk about the international community, how the Israeli occupation uses administrative detention, it's an expansion from the British Mandate era in Palestine. They are the expansion of procedures taken during the British Mandate on. So this is where we see that there isn't an integral role for the international community to stop this policy, because it's taken from similar settler colonial projects and governments who wanted to maintain control over the people, the native people and the indigenous people.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. In this episode, we hear about a product that virtually all of us use every single day. It's so much a part of our lives that the English language has even turned the company name into a verb. Yes, we're speaking about Google. In this episode, we hear from Ariel Korn. Ariel worked as a marketing manager at Google for more than 7 years. While at Google, Ariel was a strong opponent of a $1.2 billion, yes, that's billion with a B, dollar contract between Google and Amazon to supply Israel and its army with artificial intelligence tools, which would undoubtedly be used against Palestinians. The project is called Project Nimbus. We hear from Ariel about Project Nimbus, about her attempts to try to stop this project from proceeding. She tells us how Google has tried to retaliate against her for her activism and about the anti-Palestinian racism experienced by several of her colleagues at Google. Welcome, Ariel. Welcome to This is Palestine. Could you just tell me what it is that you were doing at Google and how it is that you got involved?
Yeah, I'm one of a group of many workers at this point now, hundreds of workers who have been deeply concerned about a project that our company entered into, that Google entered into in May of 2021, called Project Nimbus, which is a $1.2 billion contract between Google, Amazon, and the Israeli government and military, through which Google and Amazon are going to be providing extremely powerful tools, including artificial intelligence, to the Israeli government and military, with no right to regulate the way that the government and military actually use those tools on the ground. And we learned about this contract in May of 2021, last year, amidst the siege on Gaza, during which over 250 Palestinian people were killed at the hands of needless Israeli military violence. So it was at that moment in May of 2021 that we learned that that Google had signed Project Nimbus, and Google kind of softly and quietly and subtly, secretively rolled out this project. And they did so in a way where it was just very clear that they were attempting to eschew any sort of accountability and were hoping to be as quiet as possible, because they knew that the contract was inherently problematic and violent and controversial. And, you know, one of the biggest pieces of evidence to that point is the fact that Project Nimbus actually includes a clause that stipulates that Google and Amazon do not have the right to pull out of the contract in the event of boycott efforts or worker organizing efforts. We learned about that in May, and we've been organizing ever since, and even before then, around similar issues.
Can you tell me, Ariel, how it is that you got involved in Palestine activism?
Yes. So I'm Jewish. I'm an anti-Zionist Jew. And I'll speak specifically for the sake of brevity, like in the context of how I got involved in my workplace. Because, you know, these are, a lot of people have beliefs and convictions and that they don't necessarily bring with them to work. But for me, it was being a Jewish worker within Google and seeing the way that Google was weaponizing false narratives of Jewish identity and false narratives of anti-Semitism as a tool through which to sustain a culture of censorship and violence against Palestinians and really anyone who speaks out for Palestinian rights within the company. And I know hearing that is probably not a surprise to you because it's a phenomenon that really plays out across a lot of different institutions. But it was extremely concerning to me and some of the other anti-Zionist Jewish folks within the company to see it play out at Google, which is the world's largest search engine, because it's breeding a culture of censorship where Palestinian voices are silenced and any sort of truth about what's happening on the ground in Palestine is stifled. And so, you know, witnessing that is really what was kind of an activating force for me and made me realize I needed to get involved.
You wrote a letter about Project Nimbus. What prompted you to write this letter?
Multiple different things, but I would say the two key things are, A, I didn't really have a choice in the sense that Google retaliated against me after I spoke out about Project Nimbus, and also because of the organizing efforts that I was a part of. You know, immediately after leading efforts alongside many of my coworkers to draw awareness to Project Nimbus and the fact that it's a major crisis of conscience, and then also immediately after speaking out as a Google worker against Project Nimbus, Google retaliated against me by moving my role overseas. So when I first spoke out about Project Nimbus, I was actually on disability leave from the company, and I returned 2 weeks after I first spoke out publicly, and I was one of just two workers from within Google to speak out publicly. And the second day back, my second day back from disability leave, my manager told me that the company had decided to move my role overseas, effective immediately, and I would be given 17 days to commit to moving. And if within those 17 days I didn't commit, I would lose my job. And he even said, oh, you know, but I could try to write you a letter of recommendation. So it was just really unfounded because he was saying that the company had made a decision based on urgent business needs for me to be in Sao Paulo. But this was the middle of the surge of Omicron. It was in November. I immediately went and I spoke to folks who were in the Brazil office in Sao Paulo, and all of them were saying that they were all working remotely from home. They had no idea how there could possibly be any sort of business justification. It made absolutely no sense. And Google was never really able to articulate why it was so urgent for me to be there. And even though they make the decision on just the second day, my boss was already communicating to the team that I was leaving. And so people were like, what? Like, you resigned, you're leaving the team? And of course, I had never resigned. I had never said I was leaving. So it was just really clear that, you know, they were retaliating and trying to find a clever way to essentially force me out of the company without firing me. Because when you fire someone, you know, you're not being creative in such a way where you can issue any sort of legal accountability. So it was just very clear that this was an act of retaliation. So that's the first reason, you know, that literally they made it impossible for me to stay at the company. The second is the fact that, you know, I felt that it was really important to resign in a way where I could actually send out a letter to Google workers and also members of the general public, because I believe a company as large as Google, it's not just the workers who have a right to transparency, it's also the general public. I thought it was really important for me to send out a resignation letter that shared the deeply ingrained cultural issues that I've witnessed during my time at the company. You know, it's a weaponization of anti-Semitism where the company essentially weaponizes diversity, claims to be protecting against anti-Semitism, but what they're really doing is just censoring anyone who speaks out for Palestine. And so one of the things that I shared in my resignation letter was a link to testimonies written by 15 Google workers, 15 of my colleagues from across, you know, all different areas within the company, many of whom are Palestinian, others are Arab and Muslim and anti-Zionist Jewish folks who are in solidarity with Palestinians, writing about their experiences. Some of those experiences are things so egregious that it's really just hard to believe that this is playing out systemically. But, you know, someone shared an experience of just identifying as Palestinian within the company and literally being called into HR and issued a formal warning just because they identified as Palestinian. Another worker shared having a keffiyeh, like, and wearing Palestinian clothing in their picture in the company, like everyone has their company, you know, their bio and their photo within the company. And they were called in and said that they needed to change their photo, that this was offensive, and they were issued a formal warning. Another colleague, like, wrote the words Free Palestine in their company bio and were literally called into HR and told they had to delete those words. They were given a warning And then, you know, after they refused to delete those words and they continued to share out news about what's happening in Palestine, which is, it's really common to share news in Google, they were then called back into HR. They were given a performance deduction, issued the lowest performance ranking, and also their bonus was taken away. And they were told that they would be fired if this happened again. So these are just a few of many examples of just an egregious culture of censorship and harm.
Since you've written the letter, have you received any backlash and have you received any support?
Yeah, absolutely. I can speak to the backlash, but first I do want to speak to the support first, because frankly, it's been very significant and I think it deserves more of a platform than the backlash.
Yeah, it really does. You're absolutely right.
So to speak to the support, first, what I want to say is that, you know, I resigned last week, and up till that point, the workers who had gone public against Nimbus were just me and my colleague, Gabriel Schubiner. It was just the two of us. And since last week, there are now 10 Google workers who are publicly denouncing Project Nimbus. That's a huge win, and it's a really, really big deal. You know, workers who are standing out with their names, with their faces, and saying, I stand against Project Nimbus, first of all. Second of all, 15 workers bravely shared their testimonies. Many of them are Palestinian workers, and they shared out anonymous testimonies about these experiences, which I think is moving the needle, because I think the biggest way to really create change when it comes to a corporation like Google is public accountability, because Google's made it really clear that pursuing internal channels will just result in not only you being ignored, but literally experiencing retaliation. So that I think is really important. And yesterday we had protests across four different cities, New York City, San Francisco, Seattle, and Durham, North Carolina, outside of the Google and Amazon offices. Workers walked out. We had civil society there backing workers. We had community members. There were hundreds and hundreds of people. Imagine the entire street full of people mobilizing outside of the Google and Amazon offices, calling on them to rescind Project Nimbus and to discontinue their complicity in Israeli apartheid and settler colonial violence. So it was just an extremely powerful moment where you see so many people coalescing, coming together and calling on their companies to do the right thing, even in the face of risk of retaliation and this culture of censorship.
That's incredible. As I was sharing with you, one of the feelings that you get living in Palestine is of loneliness, of that somehow there's a whole world that is watching and seeing and aware of what Israel's doing and yet doing nothing. And so it's a very lonely feeling. So this is, I'm glad you're highlighting the support, because it is so important for people to hear that there is support out there and that it isn't just what the state of Israel wants and the state of Israel's supporters, but that there are people who are out there who are pushing back. At the same time, there's still the people on the other side. And did you receive any backlash?
Of course, right? Of course. I think Google has attempted to create a major chilling effect, right? I think the fact that they retaliated against me, that wasn't just about getting rid of me as an individual. It was about sending a message to the workforce, because of the fact that for many years, even before Project Nimbus, I've been pretty visible internally, right? In terms of just pushing against Google's extremely abusive weaponizations of anti-Semitism. The source of the most backlash has been from people who have, you know, extreme right wing and Zionist views within the company. Many of them are Zionist Jewish folks, but really many, I would say more are white Christian Zionists in the company who are doing all they can to push forward a Zionist agenda and to use any platforms that they have access to within Google to push forward that agenda as well. And, you know, there has been backlash because of the fact that folks who are speaking out for Palestinian rights within the company were growing in number and in power. And that is obviously something that is a threat to them, and they don't like that. And in my resignation letter, one of the things I shared was experiences that Google would not want to be shared with anyone else in the workforce, and certainly not with the public, about, you know, these things that I've witnessed. One example being, I'll share like kind of the first example that my colleagues and I became activated around, like why we needed to bring this part of ourselves to work versus, you know, doing this stuff outside of work. And it was in the summer of 2020. And it was amidst the movement for Black Lives uprisings. And the company had issued a formal donation to the movement for Black Lives, which, you know, there was pretty broad consensus that this was a good thing. It was kind of the bare minimum that Google could do at that moment. It was a good thing. And right during that time, we received an email, we being those of us who are a part of the Jewish Employee Resource Group, which is called the Jewglers group, the Jewish Googlers group. So essentially every single Jewish person or every single person who identifies as Jewish within the company received an email where the company was apologizing for making a donation to the Movement for Black Lives. And the reason that they stated that they were apologizing was because the leadership of this group, which is a very small but extremely vocal and minority of people who have control of this ERG, this employee resource group, had issued a formal complaint saying that there were organizations within the coalition of the Movement for Black Lives that had supported the Palestinian cause and aligned themselves with the language of the Palestinian cause. And so the company was apologizing, saying that those donations had been anti-Semitic. So we were just mortified to see this playing out in our company. We found it to be so incredibly problematic. And so a group of progressive Jewish folks put together a letter that we sent to leadership calling on them to rescind the apology, to center Black folks within the company's voices and no one else when making decisions about how to support the Black community, and to stand firmly by their donation that they had made. And not only did leadership ignore us, but leadership ended up issuing a $400,000 donation to four right-wing non-Black organizations during exactly that moment that were supposedly those donations. The company was claiming that they had been made in the name of fighting anti-Semitism. So they were weaponizing diversity. In reality, what they were doing is they were donating in the middle of the Movement for Black Lives uprisings to four groups that were right-wing groups that all four of them have as a central pillar of their work support for the Israeli military and the Israeli government. One of the groups is even under leadership of a prominent Trump advisor who had advised the Trump administration in their decision to move the embassy, the U.S. embassy, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which was, of course, an extremely harmful and horrible decision. So, you know, it was just mortifying. And it was at that moment that we realized we really needed to organize within the company. And because, you know, when you have the world's largest search engine, an extremely powerful, immeasurably powerful company that's abusing power and money and weaponizing diversity and false narratives of diversity to perpetuate harm, you have to really do something. So that's when we formed the group Jewish Diaspora and Tech, which is a group of anti-Zionist Jews within Google who are in alliance with the Google Palestine Committee and other, you know, communities from across the company in just expressing solidarity with Palestinians within the company and also ultimately our users, right? Like Palestinians are also our users at the end of the day.
So are you worried for your colleagues or for your former colleagues that have also been working alongside with you?
Well, you know, the way I feel is I feel a deep sense of hope that after Google retaliated against me, the decision to make that information public, I have hope that that will hopefully help to protect other workers. Because I think when Google and large companies in general, not just Google, but, you know, specifically Google in this case, when they retaliate against a worker, what they're banking on is that worker's silence. And it was interesting because after the act of retaliation occurred, my gut reaction was I literally called my coworkers whom I've been organizing with and some of the civil society orgs that are supporting us. I immediately called them and I was just like, I'm so sorry, guys, I'm going to have to quit. And they're like, what do you mean you're going to have to quit? And I'm like, well, there's just nothing else I can do. And they say, no, you have to fight back. If you quit, you're feeding into that system. And you know, that's the worst thing that could happen. So what we did instead is that workers mobilized, put together a petition. Almost 800 workers signed a petition calling on Google to rescind its act of retaliation. And when Google ignored that petition, we ended up going public as well. And then there was a public petition with 25,000 signatures and a significant amount of just public pressure and attention. And I think and I hope that Google will see that when they retaliate, there will be people holding them accountable, and that workers, instead of being silenced by this sort of retaliation, only become more activated and angry. And that's what happened in my case. You know, the really, I've just seen an outpouring of honestly just anger from the workforce. They are so angry that this happened. And that anger has activated and motivated people who feel safe and who feel that they have a relative amount of privilege to speak out to do so. And so I think the more workers speaking out, the more close to impossible, the more difficult it becomes for Google to retaliate without, you know, any sort of legal accountability.
Speaking of accountability, what can Google and Amazon users do to take action against Project Nimbus? Is there anything else that we can do?
Yes, there is. So there is actually a campaign called No Tech for Apartheid. This is a campaign that was started by civil society organizations, including Empower Change and the Jewish Voice for Peace. But now, you know, hundreds of organizations are getting behind the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. And the No Tech for Apartheid campaign was also helping to organize the protests that occurred this past week. So if you go to notechforapartheid.com, you can actually sign the petition calling on Google and Amazon to rescind Project Nimbus. And beyond that, you know, getting involved in taking direct action, I think, is really powerful. If you're a shareholder of Google, you have immense amounts of power. We're seeing more and more shareholders who are starting to speak out as well. So I think that is really powerful. And I think leveraging, you know, whatever your positionality is to do something, because it's really going to be this coalescence between people from all different kind of sectors and areas coming together that's going to make the difference. So academia, you know, community organizers, other tech workers, if you work in another tech company, even if you don't work at Google and Amazon, like being a tech worker, you have a voice. I think it's really important for as many people as possible to speak out, be it on social media or with your friends or sending emails. You can actually email Google executives. Their emails are public information. You can also email your local representatives, right? Your Congress people, your government, and urge them to urge Google and Amazon to do the right thing as well. So I think, you know, keeping the momentum going, we're at a really important inflection point right now where we're finally, you know, we're finally forcing Google and Amazon to have some, to take some sort of accountability, because the public is watching, the public is aware of Project Nimbus. And I think, you know, continuing to build that momentum and to speak out is really important. So bit.ly/google-voices, at bit.ly/google-voices, you can find the testimonies of 15 Google workers, Palestinian workers, and other workers who are in solidarity with Palestinians at the company. And I think it's really important to amplify these stories, because the public has the right to know what's happening at Google, and also because amplifying the voices of Palestinian Google workers is just so incredibly important right now, especially because of the fact that not only do our Palestinian colleagues, not only are they forced to face this deeply ingrained culture of censorship and silencing within the company, but there's the compounded fear that speaking out could also be essentially putting them or their families and their communities in danger. And so there's this compounded fear of retaliation at the hands of Israeli government violence, but at the hands of institutional violence. And so I think amplifying these stories that were bravely shared is just really, really important.
I will for sure. And thank you. You know, it's just, thanks for not looking the other way. Thank you for not ignoring it, because it is easy to ignore it. Thank you for persisting. Thank you for leading the way. Thank you for standing up for your principles. It's, we don't see that a lot these days. And so thank you, really.
Oh, I really appreciate that. I just came up with one more thing.
Please.
You just made me think of one more thing that I would also want to quote one of my coworkers and friends, a Palestinian colleague of mine who is a worker within Google, who shared in their testimony. I want to share these words that they ended their testimony with. And it was a message to fellow Google workers. So if any Google worker is listening to this, I think it's really important to hear. You have a voice, and you have the responsibility to use that voice when those who are less privileged than you are the ones whose jobs and livelihoods are on the line. I think that's just so important, especially if you're a Google worker listening. Like, choose action over apathy. This should, our Palestinian colleagues cannot fight this battle on their own. They shouldn't have to fight this battle on their own. That isn't fair. And the more and more workers who speak out, the more success we're going to have in holding our company accountable and being successful in our effort to really just force Google to do the right thing.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
From helmets to sunscreen, we do everything we can to keep our kids safe. So how can the COVID-19 vaccine help protect them? COVID-19 vaccines can help keep children safe from severe illness and potential long-term effects of the virus. Millions of children in Canada and around the world have